Hey everybody, in this video we're going to cover the 5 top myths about Inner Source. Hi, my name's Martin Woodward and I used to work on the team at Microsoft that helped the company adopt Inner Source. So I wanted to kind of take you through what Inner Source is, explain Microsoft's history with it, and then let's go through the 5 myths I heard when working on this with Teams. So first of all, what is Inner Source? It's taking the same tools and practices that you do with open source projects and applying those inside your organization on your private source code. And it's helping you communicate across teams. Because if we look at the average enterprise, most people struggle with communication across divisions or even, you know, between floors of the same building, if I'm honest. And there's this lack of understanding often in teams around the open source style workflows, how you use those, probably often from lack of experience in using those workflows to do pull requests and things like this. We also see inside organizations, another challenge is people quite often have large monolithic code bases, and sometimes it's harder to kind of break those down into modules and do open source and inner source across those. We certainly saw this inside of Microsoft, along with quite a lot of, you know, code ownership. Rather than feeling about your code as a maintainer of your code, you know, you think about the code as we own it, my team owns it, or my department owns it, when really it's owned by the entire organization and you are the maintainers, you are the, you know, you look after that code. So if we look at modern enterprise practices, we quite often see there's lots of, you know, innovation that's happening from all directions. So you want to be able to take ideas from different people inside your organization and share them. We see a big change in modern engineering practices in terms of shifting left. So doing things earlier in the development process, whether that's, you know, testing everything in the pull request rather than at the very end of a build, or maybe it's actually having security checks happen as soon as you push code into your code base rather than waiting for the very end or even waiting for it to be deployed before you security test. The other thing we see that's quite common in high-performing modern engineering teams is the notion of sharing. Is sharing not just with your colleagues, but also with the rest of the team. I mean, in DevOps, you know, that obviously sharing is key there. You've got Dev and Ops working together on the same thing. But being able to share across teams, don't have these silos of knowledge, but make sure everybody in the organization's on the same page. If we look at engineering in Microsoft today, we see we've got around about 110,000 users on our engineering system. Interestingly, only about 58,000 of those are actual, you know, developers, people checking in code every day. The rest of people are, you know, people like me, overhead and delete email, whatever. But we are all in the same system, working together, building these systems together. We also have, we've gone from probably in 2014, the first repository on GitHub, to now where we are today with 8,500 public repositories on GitHub. That's just the public ones alone. And we also shipping around about 82,000 times a day. Well, that's deployments a day, which is kind of a vanity metric, really. You know, that's pushing to test environments and pre-production environments. The average team probably ships, you know, a highly productive team would be testing, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day. Or, you know, you get teams that are shipping a couple of times a week or sometimes every couple of weeks, that sort of thing. But across the whole of a company, on average, about 82,000 deployments a day, which is a massive change in the past 10 years. A lot of that's been driven by those teams, but it's also come from the top as well. So Satya Nadella, our CEO, he's been very clear about making sure we focus on our engineering tools inside of Microsoft and our engineering practices to make sure we're using the most modern tools and the most modern practices that we can. Satya is very keen as well that we invest in our engineering tooling and that we build on that so we can improve productivity and invest it ready for the future. Now, when it comes to Inner Source, this isn't a particularly new thing at Microsoft. It's certainly something that people have been trying to do since the company was founded, really. We're a company that's based on, you know, the software that we create, and so it makes sense to try and figure out how we share that across the organization. But it started in the very early days with a thing called Toolbox, which was literally a file share on a computer called Toolbox. And engineers used it to share tools between each other in the organization, whether that's, you know, a handy test script or a handy test utility, that sort of thing, or maybe, you know, some pre-production code. It was mostly used to share binaries, not really source code, because back then source code was mostly done over file shares. You remember SourceSafe was kind of file share based rather than, you know, proper IP network protocol based systems. And so it's difficult to share source code in that way, mostly binaries. But it was still, it became popular. And then as we went on in 2006, we took a fork of our CodePlex code base. So CodePlex was our open source hosting site that we had publicly. We took a fork of that, brought it internally, and then made that available to engineers inside of Microsoft to use it to share different products with each other, share code bases. That was done very explicitly on certain utilities that people were building, again, and making them available to share. Here's an example of Mouse Without Borders, which was a tool for using a mouse across multiple machines. That's actually now available open source on GitHub, but at the time it was available on CodeBox, available to share across people in the organization. Then in late 2014, we started work on what we call One ES, that's One Engineering System. Up until this point, every team in Microsoft really had their own engineering tools. And when you move teams, you quite often had to learn a whole different way of working. We decided we would standardize and use one code base, one tool set across the organization. So we did that, and it was basically built on top of Azure DevOps for private code and then GitHub for public code. And then within Azure DevOps, what we actually did was we changed it so that every person in engineering was able to see the rest of the engineering system. So, you know, I as a developer on Azure could see the Windows code base, Windows could see the Office code base, and try and improve a bit of sharing in that way. The biggest change came in the summer of 2015. Satya Nadella had come in as a CEO, and he was created 1 week, which is a week where we get everybody together and we all learn and we all do different things as a company. And part of 1 week is a hackathon that we run where, again, everybody in the company is invited. We run it online and it helps people get together in teams and build solutions. So in the summer of 2015, getting ready for the hackathon, we made a change to Azure DevOps just for the Microsoft Active Directory tenant so that you could come in and change the visibility of a project and make it visible to everybody else within that AD tenant. So in this case, it was within the Microsoft organization. And we were able to use Azure DevOps at that time for our hackathon as a way of sharing code. So rather than using this external system, we were able to use our core engineering system as part of the hackathon and get everybody working together. That hackathon was actually great, you know, for the first hackathon. Some good ideas came out of that. And in fact, the Xbox Adaptive Controller, which you can see in stores now, that came out of the hackathon in summer 2015. An engineer called Matt Height was working on different controllers, and he decided to get everybody together and did an initial version based on a Kinect controller. And this is to build a controller for people, you know, with limited mobility and who typically struggle with an existing Xbox controller. Then Matt went and built another team in 2016's hackathon and worked on that some more to build this controller out. And that became what today you can buy in stores as the Xbox Adaptive Controller. And there's been lots of ideas that have gone through hackathons and actually come out of things. But the main benefit of these hackathons is to get everybody together, get everybody sharing ideas and build these relationships across the business and, you know, really start to share and build the community. Now, after the hackathon brought this to market and we started working, we then needed to work, you know, a bit more on the ways that we communicate. By this time, let's say we created our GitHub account in 2014, and then as we moved on, we started to do more and more work in the open. And we started to learn as engineers, we started to learn how to communicate with people through issues, through pull requests. Often when you're working in an open source project, people don't share the same deadlines as you. They work for different companies, they've got different priorities. And learning to work in that way sort of really helped change the culture inside Microsoft, so we could communicate with those people and learn different tools and techniques, all based in GitHub. And what was interesting is by learning how to do that, it kind of also helped us learn how to communicate better internally. Because if you think about a typical enterprise, you've got lots of different groups with lots of different deadlines, and you're all working towards, you know, different solutions, all for the value of your company, but you've got different goals. And so knowing how to work in that way really helped educate us how to work better internally. As we have developed inside Microsoft, we have more and more teams now that are using open source as part of the core of what they do. So they'll maybe have one or two components that they work on that are completely in the open, and then another couple that are closed, that are private code. And we're finding the engineering system kind of blur across those lines between different systems. And so what we're actually doing is starting moving the entire organization over to GitHub, or moving more and more of it that way anyway, so that we can share more work across this platform a lot closer. And also because this kind of social coding features that are built into GitHub really help you when it comes to doing inner source collaboration. So once we've decided to get everything into GitHub and start to learn the lessons we've got there, we're looking at some of the projects that have been most successful on GitHub and seeing what we can learn. And interestingly, one of the most successful projects across everything in GitHub, not just Microsoft, but across all open source projects, has been Visual Studio Code. Now, interestingly, Visual Studio Code came the other way. It actually started as an inner source project. The team, when they were building, they built an editor control called Monaco. And that's available now on GitHub as a public project. But at the time, they built it as an inner source project, made it available to other people with inside the organization, really did a lot of work on documentation, showing you how to use it. And then lots of different teams picked up that editor control, contributed changes to it, but also gave the team this real world testing and these real world requirements that helped them improve that editor control. And then eventually it became Visual Studio Code, which we all know and love today. And it's also the basis of Visual Studio Code Spaces, which was announced at Build. So it's a success story of inner source that's then become open source, which is quite interesting. Right, so let's go review some of the myths I've heard across teams when I've tried to sort of get people doing inner source a bit more, and some of the objections people have, that sort of thing. So let's start with number 5 in the inner source top myth countdown is we'll get free stuff. Now, lots of teams, when you're talking to them, think, oh, if I make this inner source, people will start contributing to me my project for free. I don't have to do anything. Magic, I get engineering. That's sadly to say, that's not how it works. There is actually you do have to pay a bit of a tax to share with people, to talk to people. And you don't just magically get free contributions out of nowhere. But you will get contributions if you try and if you learn how to build that way. So let's look at the data. If we take Microsoft in last year, so 2019 across the calendar year, if you see who contributes the code, still 90% of the pull requests that get merged into the typical code base inside of Microsoft have come from you, the team. They haven't come from outside. It's not magic free code. It's not the magic, you know, pull request pixies or anything like this. 90% of the code comes from within the team, just as before. However, 9% of that code has come from a nearby team, so teams close to you, probably within the same division. But 1% of it has come from, you know, the other end of the business. So you can see that most of the code that we're writing on these internal projects is coming from those internal teams, but we're able to get contributions from outside different areas of the business. However, everybody in the business has been able to see that code base and has been able to share it and reuse parts and take ideas and that sort of thing. But if we look at, say, something like .NET, that's massively different. You know, .NET's a public open source project, and despite it being really, really technical, it has over 65% of its pull requests have come from outside of Microsoft. So when we sit back and really look at how that community has built up and how we've, you know, gone and worked in that community, it's quite interesting. So the first thing that we did with .NET was we made the source available. So people could see the source. They couldn't really do anything with it. They could read it. And, you know, we got some interest. People were involved. It certainly helped debugging issues and that sort of thing, if you remember, trying to figure out what was going on in the base class library or something like that. It was very helpful. We then started to make our design notes available. So, you know, how we were going to change things. And again, that was good because we got early contribution. We were able to iterate very quickly. But it's still, weren't getting much contribution. We weren't getting a huge amount of involvement just from the really, you know, passionate, in-depth people. The next stage that we did was we went open with our code, but we had limited contributions. We actually published the source code from TFS at the time over to Coplex at the time, and we could take contributions back in, but we weren't working in that code base. We were just publishing to that code base and then manually pulling changes back, merging them, and then pushing them out eventually. There were slow feedback times. There wasn't really much live discussion happening on those issues. But we, you know, it was available under an open source license. This was progress. Where we saw this massive uptick in contribution was when we really adopted a true community workflow. So we moved our engineers into GitHub, and we had them doing pull requests to the project just like they were anybody else who was contributing from outside the organization. And we found that was massively important, that you don't treat your engineers as special. They, you know, they follow the same process as the rest of the community for code reviews and things. And you're truly part of that community. When that happened, we saw this huge uptick in interest and participation. And that meant we actually had to improve our documentation, make it easier to get started in the code, make it easier to find things, help understand why we were doing certain things that way. And then the final thing that happened was we created the .NET Foundation, and we actually started the sharing the ownership of .NET and making it so the .NET platform was truly shared, was truly owned, not just by one team, but shared across lots of teams. And if we kind of step back on that, what I try and explain this to people is with a contribution funnel. So with, you know, if you think about the funnel of contribution, like you think about a sales funnel or those sorts of activities, you know, business activities, most people looking at your project just consume. They just drive by, download the software, use it, never come back again. If it doesn't work for them, they'll maybe never ever come back again, you know. And that's fine. That's what open source and inner source is about. At least they've been able to find something, try it, consume it, it solved their problem, off they go. Brilliant. Improved productivity, that's fantastic. But a very small percentage of them will come back and they'll contribute time. And so your job as a maintainer of your code base is to maximize the number of people that go from consumption to contribution. So to do that, you need to make it easier for people to consume that software. You want to have, you know, a good README. You want to have make it easy to download, install, not too many prerequisites. You want to have a screenshot that shows people what it is they get when they install this software, that sort of thing. So you maximize the people in the top of the funnel. And then to make it easy to contribute back in, you give clear instructions about how to log an issue, how to create documentation, what sort of things you would like help testing. And you'll bring a larger percentage of people down into contributing time. And then a very small percentage of those people will actually contribute code into your project. And code obviously is extremely helpful. Open source communities, you know, value code contribution over everything else because it is so helpful to drive the community forwards. And, you know, that might just be a fix to the issue that they found, or it might be tests or, you know, sometimes whole new features, which is brilliant and fantastic. So you need to be welcoming to these people who've contributed some time so that the small percentage of them that contribute code are maximized, that you get the most people through and be welcoming to contribute code. And then when people do contribute code to you, you want to be welcoming to them so that you can get people down into the next level of the funnel, which is where they share ownership with you and help you maintain your project. So if somebody contributes some code, you want to be responsive to that pull request, give them good feedback. You want tests running on that pull request so they get quick feedback if this code is going to be accepted or not. And then you also, you know, want to be able to provide opportunities for them to influence the future of the product direction, help with code reviews, that sort of thing. So that's kind of the contribution funnel. And you need to be thinking about how we're going to bring people down that funnel with you so that you get more and more useful contribution to the project that you're sharing. We also want to figure out how to make sure that these contributions coming in are actually helpful. It's no good, you know, getting features which you don't want to implement because you're just going to annoy them and it's going to, you know, it's going to waste your time as well. So the first thing is to make sure you've got good documentation that's inviting, that brings people in, that shows them what to do. You want to make sure you've got good governance of your project. So make sure you're responding to pull requests that come in fairly quickly. Make sure you have tests that pass like normally. So when somebody downloads that code and hits build and watch all the tests pass, you know, that it works, and then they can go and get on and fix the thing that they wanted to fix rather than trying to fix your broken software, you know, before they can even get started. And what's also quite good is to be, when you're being collaborative, if you find an issue, which is something that you want to do, but it's not at the top of your backlog yet, but it'd be good for somebody to do, you can mark that as a good first issue. If it's, you know, not too hard, it's easy enough to get started, you just don't have the time to do it yet. Mark those as good first issues, and then people who are looking at contributing can do that. And so if we look at the documentation side, we can see, you know, it's good to have a README that kind of helps people see where they are, see what this project does, how to get started in it. In that, if you describe the contribution process, and there's a contributing.md file that will show up in the right places, but that'll help bring people in and help them contribute in a way that's helpful to you. And we'll save their time as well. And this is all about being welcoming and bringing people down that contribution funnel. And then the other thing that you want to make sure you've got is this query of easy first contributions, and also make sure you're responding to your issues, responding to those pull requests. If you can keep your code kind of clean and commented and approachable, that really helps. You'll find as you start to do more and more sharing and more inner source, it actually helps you make your code more modular, because you're trying to group code together into bite-sized, more consumable chunks. And so it actually leads to more modular code, which is quite an interesting side effect. Okay, that's enough of that one. Let's go on to the next one. So on the top five myths of inner source, at number four, we have gamification. So let them eat badges, as I've said. This is so many times, you know, people said, oh, how do I get people to contribute to my project? How do I get people sharing with inside our organization? I know, we'll give them badges if they share, or we'll give them stickers. Now, don't get me wrong, developers love stickers. You know, it's amazing what you can get for stickers. But it's not going to build an entire culture of sharing inside your organization. If people are not rewarded to share with more than just stickers and more than just badges, then they're not going to share. They're going to do, you know, you're going to need to see what culture you set inside your organization. Inside Microsoft, we actually changed our incentive structure. So the way that people get paid. The interesting thing that we found is we needed to build an economy of sharing. It's no good just telling people to share or telling, you know, unless there are people who are prepared to consume those shared components. Otherwise, you're going to have lots of people trying to share things and nobody wanting to work with them to share with them. So we actually changed our incentive structure. So when you're demonstrating your impact, you don't just demonstrate your own personal impact. You demonstrate what impact you've had on the work of others. But you also have to demonstrate what impact you've had building on the work of others. And that encourages a couple of things. It encourages you to go look for people to share with and to collaborate with, to consume what they are sharing. But it also encourages you to acknowledge these people that you're working with, because that's how you get rewarded. And so it's building this entire culture of sharing, this economy of sharing with inside of the business. And this is driven, you know, not just within teams, this comes all the way from the top as well. These are the incentives inside of Microsoft and how we judge everybody. Right then, number three in the top five myths of Inner Source is people want to wait before publishing. Developers are very, oh no, I can't publish this code. I need to tidy this code up before I can publish it. I hear that all the time. And it's a very, very, very natural fear that you have if you don't want to publish this because everybody can see it. You want to make it look beautiful. And then you never get around to tidying it up and you never publish it. So my biggest advice is just to publish it, especially for Inner Source, because there's no risk to the organization. So it's not like you're distributing things outside of the organization where sometimes you might want to do some scanning and things. So just share it. Get over that emotional hurdle and just start sharing. And the thing I also say to people is, look, this code works. This code is running on a billion devices around the world. You know, if it's good enough to run on people's machines, it's good enough to share it in the organization. And people will learn from it. People will be able to do stuff with this. So just get over that, unfortunately, is kind of the biggest advice. But know that it's natural and know that everybody feels that way as well. And number two in the top five myths about Inner Source is that framework teams are a good idea. That's just not usually the case. We often find people thinking, oh, I can go into my little ivory tower and just go build a framework and not have any real customers to talk to. And that's just a recipe for scope creep, if you ask me. We try and have it so that teams are still responsible for shipping code to the customer's hands, you know, giving value to your customers, and that they're doing that by sharing components with each other. So a component has a strong business case. And yes, it might not do everything that every team in the business wants to do, but it does what the team who built it wants to do. And they're making the code available and they're accepting pull requests. If somebody would like it to do something else, then they can submit that pull request. Maybe they don't, in which case they can fork that code and use part of it and move on and share. So try and avoid framework teams whenever possible, just to prevent scope creep, really. Right, number one in the top five myths about Inner Source, and this is one I hear everywhere I go. I hear this one all the time, and that's Inner Source won't work here. That's certainly something, you know, you might have thought inside of Microsoft 10 years ago, oh, there's no way we can have all these teams working together. You know, that's just not how we work. That's not what we do here. But if we can make it work, if we can build a culture of sharing, then you can too. It doesn't mean everything has to be shared. There are still things inside of Microsoft that aren't shared. There are tented projects, we call them, that are private projects. But that's an explicit decision to make something private. It's not the default. Inside a bank, you very likely have code that cannot be shared widely. But you probably also have, you know, a string handling library or a date handling thing. Hopefully you get that one from open source. But anyway, hopefully you've got some code that's common across the whole business. Maybe the way that you look at account numbers or things like this, you can share those across the whole business. There's no IP there that's private to that one team. So you are able to come in and you are able to share code. So think about what you can share and how you can start building a culture where sharing becomes the default. And we see this happening across lots of businesses around the world. NASA is a great example, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where they've increased their code reuse now to on GitHub to greater than 90%. And they've seen a 20-fold increase in collaboration, which is just amazing. But you can see some big names there of lots of companies who've seen increase of performance and an increase of sharing by adopting Inner Source cultures inside their organization. Right, so let's recap now. If we look at the key features, what makes Inner Source engineering systems? So the first one is that you build an economy of sharing inside your organization. Teams are incentivized to share with other people and they're incentivized to consume those shared libraries. Let's build this economy. An Inner Source model is one that allows permissive read access, so lots of people in the organization can read that code and can log issues and that sort of thing. But a very small percentage, the team, have the restricted write access. So the team who own that code, who maintain that code, still control what goes in it. They're not losing control. People can suggest changes, but they still have the control of what's in that code. And so it's restricted write, permissive read is a classic, you know, Inner Source pattern. You need to make sure you've got discoverability of projects. It's no good just sharing things and having permissive read if you can't find them. If you're trying to find that library inside your organization that does that thing that you need, how do you find it? Where do you go? You need this discoverability. You also need good documentation. Sharing code isn't an excuse to stop writing docs. You know, you can't say, oh, the code is the documentation. That doesn't cut it. You need good documentation that shows people how to use that code, how to consume it, so you can maximize the people in your contribution funnel so that you can gain value from sharing by having people send you submissions and that sort of thing. You also need a well-documented and easy-to-set-up developer environment. If you think about the number of times you've been to a library and you want to make a change to it, but to get the dev environment means like 4 or 5 days of work, setting up prerequisites, installing machines, all that sort of stuff. That's just painful. Nobody's going to go through all that pain unless they're really, really, really motivated. This is one of the reasons why I'm really excited about Visual Studio Code Spaces and GitHub Workspaces, because they allow you to set up these development environments really quickly and then share those with your teams. And that helps not just you in terms of build reproducing issues and being able to get a dev environment set up. It helps when people are trying to consume code and then contribute fixes. The other thing that's common in InnerSource is this pull request model. You want to cross organizational forks. So you can fork a code base if you don't have read access to it. You can make a change to that code and then you can send a pull request to the upstream maintainers so that then you're able to take advantage of the changes that they added as well as the changes that you wanted to their code base. It's great if those pull requests are validated by reliable tests and that have great test coverage, because that gives you a much quicker feedback loop to your pull request to know if you're heading in the right lines before any human comes and does a code review. Okay, this is about it. I want to wrap up now. Thank you very much for taking the time and watching this video, if you still are. My name again is Martin Woodward. If you want to get hold of me, it's Martin Woodward on Twitter, or you can email martinwoodward@github.com. If you want to learn more about InnerSource, then go to the InnerSourceCommons.org, which is a great website with lots of like-minded people who are all trying to do InnerSource inside their organizations. And if you want to learn more about Microsoft's journey, then go to aka.ms/developerstories. Thank you very much.